Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, September 19th, 2018. We start with the news section. Are scooters mopeds? State law thinks so. That could present a problem in Durham. After motorized scooters dropped unannounced in Raleigh and Chapel Hill, Durham officials began preparing for the same inevitability, but their fix is presenting headaches of its own. A proposed revision to a city ordinance defines motorized scooters as mopeds under North Carolina law. That subjects the scooters to a host of equipment requirements in order to be safely driven on roads, where Durham scooter users would be relegated. The problem is the electric scooters descending on the American cities don't generally have all of the requisite moped stuff. Inflatable tires, lights for riding at night, a mirror, registration, and a license plate. We have a balance to strike in this between having the scooters operating and providing benefits to the city and not, says Councilmember Charlie Reese, who ventured to Raleigh last week to give a Bird scooter a spin. He reports that it was scary and exciting in equal measure. The balance we have to strike is that scooters will almost certainly come here at some point. The danger is that because of a quirk in state law, there are certain legal requirements that the statutes impose on the devices that they will not meet when they are deployed. According to Cody Sharlin, Bird's Raleigh's fleet manager, Bird scooters have inflatable tires and lights, but not mirrors or license plates. Although Sharlin says he can't speak to whether those features could be added, it's also unclear whether the scooters meet the registration requirement. But the company's government affairs representatives don't seem concerned about the moped part of the proposal. They didn't bring it up in a recent email to the city council expressing support, with some reservations, for the ordinance or in remarks at Monday's city council meeting. The proposal would ask companies seeking permits to operate in the city to affirm that their devices meet the moped requirements outlined by state law. Actually, making sure that they do is a whole other problem. As such, council members on Monday night delayed a vote on the ordinance until they could get input from the city's Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee and the Durham Police Department, which could be put in the position of telling unsuspected riders that the scooter they just rented doesn't comply with the law. Under state statute, it's a misdemeanor to drive an unregistered moped on the street or to allow a moped you own to be driven unregistered. Moped riders also have to be at least 16 and must wear helmets. City Attorney Patrick Baker says whether the term moped is in the ordinance or not, the classification is basically unavoidable. Scooters are obviously not cars, ATVs, bikes, or electric-assisted bikes as defined by state law. Personal-assisted mobility device, like Segways, would be a nice bucket to drop them in if that definition didn't specify that they have two wheels, not in tandem. Once you stick a motor on it, it's got to be some sort of motorized vehicle, Baker says. Through the process of elimination, you end up with, it must be a moped. What's more, city code prohibits bikes and vehicles on sidewalks, and the council hasn't expressed a desire to treat zippy 15-mile-per-hour scooters differently. So, they have to go on roads, which means they have to have lights, a mirror, and inflatable tires, like mopeds. In meetings about the scooters, council members also haven't made pleas to outright ban the things, as cities from San Francisco to Miami have done, or let them exist in a lawless state, as Reese describes the current situation in Raleigh, where city staffers have been given 2 months to craft an ordinance regulating scooters that are already there. Unlike Durham, Raleigh doesn't have a dockless bike share program whose regulations can be amended to cover scooters. The scooters offer an alternative to cars for short trips, particularly the last bit of a commute after exiting public transportation, and take up less space than bikes. Companies round them up nightly to avoid the kind of clutter that has prompted complaints about Durham's bike share system. Durham's existing ordinance requires companies to make the shared transportation device accessible to low-income areas. The proposed revision adds a requirement to accommodate people without smartphones or credit cards. Bird has some qualms about this last part because the service is built around an app. But their first ride, customers must snap a photo of any government ID showing they are at least 18. After each ride, they're asked to take a picture proving they parked properly. The company does discount fees for anyone enrolled in state or federal assistance programs. Cerzando Esparza, Bird's senior manager of government relations, also asked council members Monday night to revisit a $100 per device fee, which he said is one of the higher ones of all the cities we operate in. City officials have asked the DMV and the Attorney General's Office for guidance, but ultimately, they think a change in state law is needed to define this new technology. Today's the challenge that this is what we're having, Baker said. This is a case where the technology is out in front of the legislation. The next news article, Pass the Bucks. Some way commissioners want to make the school board responsible for school funding. It's not as easy as it sounds. Ending the sometimes acrimonious school funding feud between the Wake County Board of Commissioners and the Board of Education could be as simple as empowering the school board to raise taxes rather than forcing schools to rely on the county's largesse every year. 4 current commissioners want the legislature to let them try. But as intuitive as it might sound, school board members are elected to oversee the school system. So why not make them determine school tax rates? The effort faces an uncertain future. Last week, commissioners included the taxing authority change on their 2019 wish list of legislative goals. However, the item was temporarily pulled from a work session agenda pending the adoption of the NC Association of County Commissioners goal for next year's legislative session, according to Assistant County Manager Chris Dillon. The board will review the proposed change again in January, after at least 2 new commissioners are sworn in. North Carolina is one of only 3 states where elected school boards depend on other local governments for funds, creating an uncomfortable dance between commissioners and school officials. The school system always needs more money. County officials want to tell voters they're improving schools while also keeping taxes low. In recent years, even with all Democratic Board of Commissioners avowedly committed to education funding, the resulting compromise hasn't satisfied school advocates. This year, Wake Schools asked for $69 million in new funds, but received just $45 million. In 2017, the school system requested 45 and got 21. Those fights led to successful campaigns to defeat Commissioners Irv Portman and John Burns in the Democratic primary in May. Barring upsets in November, former school board member Susan Evans and longtime schools advocate Vicki Adamson will assume their seats in December. The proposed remedy for this recurring conflict? Let school system raise their own taxes. The North Carolina School Boards Association has been lobbying for this change since 2000. We haven't had any great movement in that direction, says Ed Dunlap, the NCSBA's executive director. I was extremely pleased to hear that the Wake County Board of Commissioners was interested in looking at that. Only the incarnation of the Board of Commissioners that considers the idea in January might not be all that interested. I do not believe we'll be taking that up in January, Board Chairman Jessica Holmes told the Indy Monday. I think I can speak confidently in that regard. It was a request by some individual commissioners to be considered. I was not one of them. This week, Burns, Matt Calabria, and Sig Hutchinson all said they're open to the idea. Portman has previously told the Indy he is as well. For Hutchinson, it's a way to hold school board members accountable. Calabria thinks it might add consistency to the budget process. Burns calls it good government that will correct a mismatch in responsibilities. They would have to face the same voters on the same issues that I do, he said. But with Burns and Portman out, Holmes, the staff attorney with the NC Association of Educators, will have a block of staunchly pro-education allies in Evans, Adamson, and Greg Ford, a former principal. If they don't think the change is needed, it's dead in the water. Evans and Adamson did not return phone calls by press time. Other than Mecklenburg County, which briefly considered a similar move following the failure of former State Representative Rick Glazier's 2007 bill to shift taxing authority to school boards, no other counties have taken up this initiative, says NCSBA Government Relations Director Leanne Winner. Citing a 2001 study from South Carolina, she argues that granting that authority could actually lower taxes. Overall, in the communities where the school board has become independent, taxes went up less than those in communities where the school board remained dependent, Winner said. My theory is that the school board would go in and really scrub their budget and get rid of any programs that were not overly effective. That there was a real concerted effort in those communities, before they asked the taxpayers for money, to make sure it's as tight as it can be. Winner doesn't envision the General Assembly granting all school boards taxing authority at once, but she thinks it could be feasible as a pilot program, and that's where Wake comes in. But under the state constitution, launching even a pilot program would require not just legislative approval, but also a referendum, says former legislative staffer and general counsel Jerry Cohen. The earliest such a measure could appear on the ballot would be March of 2020. A referendum would be a heavy hurdle, Cohen said, and he wouldn't vote for it. It seems to me a complete abdication of any sort of fiscal responsibility, Cohen said. Should we let the health board levy taxes? Should we let the Board of Elections levy taxes? School Board Chairwoman Monica Johnson-Hustler says she hopes any effort to change how schools are funded would be a collaboration between the school board and the commissioners. But that conversation, she adds, has yet to happen. Next, a little help from my friends. You got lucky. Here's how you can help the victims of Hurricane Florence. This weekend, Hurricane Florence delivered a crippling blow to parts of North Carolina, claiming at least 25 lives in the state alone, flooding neighborhoods and shutting down roads. All things considered, the Triangle, especially its northern end, got off easy, with just a good amount of rain and a stiff breeze to contend with. Eastern North Carolina, particularly near the coast, wasn't so lucky. The 500-mile-wide storm was a Category 1 hurricane when it made landfall at Wrightsville Beach early Friday, delivering strong winds and heavy rain. More than 1 million people were ordered to evacuate, and 20,000 sought refuge in more than 150 state shelters. Nearly half a million remained without power. Duke Energy reported Monday that figure. State and federal rescue personnel have already performed more than 900 water rescues. The impacts of Hurricane Florence will be felt for days and weeks to come as stormwaters make their way back to rivers such as the Neuse and Cape Fear, which are expected to rise dozens of feet and crest higher than they did during Hurricane Matthew. Flooding has already caused the Sanford Dam to fail, collapsed a coal ash landfill near Wilmington, and could potentially threaten public health and the environment. If floodwaters overtake a region home to high concentration of hog farms, at least one open-air lagoon has already been breached, and three others have been inundated by floodwaters. Here are some ways that you can help those affected by the storm. First, donate to the North Carolina Disaster Relief Fund. This is a fund that is operated by the state at governornc.gov. Contributions will help with the immediate unmet needs of Hurricane Florence victims. You can also text Florence to 20222. Next, the Durham Solidarity Center, Southern Vision Alliance, Blueprint North Carolina, Environmental Justice Network, Farm Labor Organizing Committee, and other groups have started an effort called A Just Florence Recovery to collect and deliver supplies directly to affected areas. Canned foods, tarps and ropes, hygiene items, over-the-counter medicine, cots and air mattresses, cleaning supplies, and plastic bags are needed. The coalition is working with Operation Airdrop to fly out of RDU and airlift supplies to inaccessible areas. Supplies can be dropped off at TAC Air Building, 1725 East International Drive, Morrisville. Volunteers are needed there to pack and sort donations. Other drop-off sites are located at the Durham Fruit Company, the Durham Co-op, the A. Philip Randolph Institute, Zog's Pool Hall, Rena Center, and Steel String Brewery. Visit another gulf.com/a.just.florencerecovery for more information and search A Just Florence Recovery /Operation Airdrop on Facebook for the latest updates. Donate to United Way's Hurricane Florence Recovery Fund at unitedway.org/recovery/Hurricane Florence. All donations will be distributed to local United Way chapters in affected areas. Or find a local United Way chapter and donate directly, like United Way of Coastal Carolina, which serves Carteret, Craven, Jones, and Pamlico counties. United Way Cape Fear area, which serves Brunswick, Columbus, New Hanover, and Pender counties, or United Way of Robeson County. Donate online at secure.actblue.com/donate/EastNC to the Eastern North Carolina Hurricane Recovery Fund. Donations will benefit on-the-ground organizations in eastern North Carolina, including Alpha Life Enrichment Center, Asociación de Mexicanos de Carolina del Norte, Genesis 457 CDC, Kinston Teens INC, Integrity CDC, Men and Women United for Youth and Families, the A. Philip Randolph Institute, and the North Carolina Association of Community Development Corporations. Contribute to the Food Bank of Eastern and Central North Carolina. For every $10 you give, the Food Bank can provide 50 meals. Make a financial donation online at foodbankecnc.org or see the Food Bank's website for drop-off locations in Raleigh and Durham. Non-perishable foods, hygiene products, and cleaning supplies are needed. DonorsChoose.org has started a Hurricane Florence Recovery Fund to help teachers and schools affected by the storm. Donations will be used to restock damaged classrooms. Donate and report damaged schools at DonorsChoose.org/hurricane/Florence. Donate at ncfield.org/donate to the NC Field Farmworker Emergency Fund to help farm workers that were in crisis. Diaper Bank of North Carolina is collecting diapers, wipes, and cash donations. The organization says it is working with the state emergency services to provide disaster relief kits with baby necessities, feminine hygiene products, and adult incontinence supplies. You can donate online at ncdiaperbank.org. Drop off diapers at 311 East Club Boulevard in Durham, or sign up to pack relief kits by emailing info@ncdiaperbank.org. The Durham Mayor's Council for Women also has organized a drive to benefit the diaper bank. Through Friday, donations can be dropped off at Polysaurus, Coco Cinnamon Lakewood, and Club Boulevard Elementary School. Core Soundwater Fowl Museum and Heritage Center is raising money to help families in the Carteret County Public School System recover after Florence. More information at coresound.com/hurricane relief. The North Carolina Disaster Legal Services effort, which provides disaster-related legal resources, is organized by the North Carolina Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. Donate at ncbarfoundation.org/donate to support its work. The Islamic Association of Raleigh and Triangle Muslim Aid are hosting a supply drive Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Islamic Association, 808 Atwater Street, Raleigh. More information at RaleighMasjid.org. Find more nonprofits assisting with Hurricane Florence aid, along with financial and accountability information, through Charity Navigator. That's CharityNavigator.org. We move now to the food section. You can call me Al. Now that his burgers are nationally famous, Al Bowers looks back on the shack that almost wasn't. A horn honk, a smile, a wave, and a shout. That's how my hour-long interview with Al Bowers is interrupted on no less than 6 occasions. And if it's not pleasantries exchanged with the myriad locals who know and love the gregarious owner of Al's Burger Shack, it's his staff begging our pardon, popping in and out of conversation with their boss as they prepare for the day's work. A check needs signing, a stereo speaker fixing, a small window pane with a crack requires his attention. "Sorry, brother," Bowers said to me with each passing hiccup, picking up exactly where he left off pre-interruption. It's a scorching hot August morning as we sit beneath the tall wooden structure adjacent to the little white brick building where Bowers first opened Al's Burger Shack in September of 2013. Since then, Al's Burger Shack, known simply as Al's to locals, has become a Chapel Hill institution, with lines that regularly stretch out the front door, down the two-step staircase, and along West Franklin Street sidewalk. Students, locals, and visitors have known for years what reviewer aggregator TripAdvisor announced this past July. Al's Burger Shack slings the best burgers in America. Specifically, its sloppy, delicious, chili sauce and onion-piled fan favorite, the Bobo Chili Cheeseburger. "Every day is Friday," Bowers said, when asked what kind of impact the honor has had on business. "You never expect anything close to this," he continues. You never dream of anything like this. It's crazy. You're blown away. To those in the know, the devotion to Al's goes beyond the fact that Bowers and his team make the best burger in America. As anyone who has been greeted by Bowers' booming voice can attest, to dine at Al's is like dining at home, even if the place is making national headlines. I think people in the hospitality business just like that thing in common, Bowers says. We just want to make sure you're happy. And to those in the want to know, people are coming from all over, Bowers said, noting how, in the wake of the Trip Advisory's designation, Al's is seeing an influx of customers from all over the country. But before the out-the-door lines before the burger stand in UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Memorial Stadium and the Al's food truck, both of which sadly are no more, before the second Al's Burger Shack location at the Southern Village, before the American's Best Burger Crown, Al's wasn't going to be a burger shack. In fact, Al's wasn't going to be anything at all. In September of 2013, after spending several years managing Merritt's Grill, another landmark Chapel Hill eatery, Bowers, who was raised in Greensboro and settled in Chapel Hill when he enrolled in UNC Chapel Hill in the mid-'80s, approached his bosses about buying into the now famous local business. They weren't interested, which I understood, but I gave my 30-day notice right there, Bowers said. With two kids, one of whom was starting college that fall, the pressure was on Bowers to figure something out fast. He leaned on his experience in real estate, where he had made his living before getting into the restaurant business at the onset of the Great Recession. Discovering that Chocolatier, the chocolate doorway, was about to vacate its West Franklinside street, Bowers, his wife Melody, and their friend and initial investor, Joe Nanny, jumped on the location. I called up the landlord, met him down there, walked inside, and a week later we had a lease, he said. I had no clue what I was going to do. Initially, Bowers planned to open a humble breakfast shop operating solely out of a curbside window. But he was pushed to think better by Melody and Nanny. They wanted something that could be open and selling all day, Bowers said. Except Sunday, of course. And they asked, well, what else do you like? Bowers' gut response was his love of hamburgers. 7 months later, Al's opened, he said. It was Melody's idea, Bowers continues, crediting his wife with the inspiration to open on Saturday, on September 18, 2013, National Cheeseburger Day. I wanted to open the first week of September when the students were back in full swing, but she said we should wait. Just as he does with Melody, Bowers is quick to give credit to others in his orbit. He lauds his wife for her support, intellect, and the recipe for Al's Burger Shack's famous rosemary fries. He mentioned his friends and former investors, without whom he may never have opened his Burger Shack in the first place. With a deep and abiding love, he sings praises most vocally and often of his staff, in whom he finds inspiration to keep pushing. When one of my staff says to me, I moved out of my parents' house, or I just bought a car, or I qualified for a house, Bowers said, and it's because you opened a hamburger joint. Man, that's powerful. Bowers mentions that, while his pay scale may be a bit higher than the food service sector average, he is more than happy to inflate the Burger Shack's bottom line if it means his employees are paid a living wage. The recognition that the money he pays his staff tends to stay in his community while simultaneously serving a bigger purpose in a microcosm of Bowers' outlook. For Bowers, focusing on the good of his local environments and his denizens, whether through their bellies or their wallets, is more important than aiming to make the best cheeseburger in America. We just strive to make the best burger on Franklin and Graham, Bowers said with a laugh, noting that he and his staff aim to control what they can control. It's the four walls theory, we control what happens inside these four walls. He's about to conclude his thought when we are interrupted once more as truck drives by, honking and waving at the genial figurehead of West Franklin Street. Also from the food section, Schmear Campaign. Big Dom's Bagel Shop brings bagels, donuts, and biscuits to downtown Cary. Bagels, donuts, and biscuits are a carb lover's trifecta, and Big Dom's Bagel Shop, which opened in downtown Cary in late August, is the one-stop shop for expertly executed takes on these bakery staples. And it's no wonder. The shop is owned by Amber and Zach Falisi, the folks behind popular Cary pizza joint, Pizzeria Falisi, who have earned a loyal following for their pies and signature dough crafts with a blend of Italian and North Carolina milled flours. Big Dom's, named after the Falisi son, specialize in Montreal-style bagels, which are smaller and denser than New York bagels and have a slightly sweet taste since they're made from a malted dough and boiled in water sweetened with brown sugar. Honey water is used in Montreal. The Felicis add their own touch by making bagels with a smear of Crisco to help crisp the bottom, producing a bagel with a satisfyingly crunchy exterior and a sublimely chewy interior. Badonuts, a baked cake donut made with loads of brown butter, and biscuits crafted with a blend of three flours round out the menu. The vibe. The aroma of a rising dough mingling with everything bagel seasoning greets you as you step inside the cozy shop. The storefront is small, but has an open feel with white walls, an angled ordering counter, and a blonde wood counter lining the windowed walls. A perfect spot the people watch while you nosh and sip. Friendly and efficient counter staff keep the order line moving, and kitchen staff quickly deliver bags of baked goods and drinks. You can either grab and go, eat at the counter, or nab a bench in the outside garden or a seat under the covered patio. Menu. The menu is spelled out on an old school letter board and features biscuits, donuts, and hard-rolled bagels. Bagel flavors include the usual suspects such as plain, sesame, everything, Asiago, cinnamon, as well as the gluten-free, GFY, gluten-friendly, yo. Extras are all schmearables and include cream cheese, butter, jam, avocado, and nut butters. There's also a lineup of sandwiches including a bacon, egg, and cheese, a BLT, and the Italian deli-inspired prosciutto, mortadello, and hot sauce pressato combo. Big Dom teases menu specials on social media, including flavored schmears such as blueberry, cannoli, and spicy pickle. Drinks include hot and iced coffee from Wake Forest Black and White Coffee, roasters, and specialty teas. What to order? I came to North Carolina by way of New Jersey, so the bagel bar is set high. I'm pleased to report that Big Dom's Bagel Shop hand-rolled bagels possess an ideal crispy, chewy texture. Toasting is optional and unnecessary when bagels are served fresh from the oven. Plain bagels best showcase the Montreal-style signature delicate sweetness. But everything bagels are my go-to, and at Big Dom's, the tops are amply scattered with the onion, garlic, sesame, and poppy seed seasoning. I paired my everything bagel with cream cheese and a cup of full-bodied nutty iced coffee, which was so good as is, it didn't need cream or sugar. Price point? Bagels, biscuits, and donuts are $2 each, and the GFY bagel is $3. A dozen bagels or biscuit is $18. Sandwiches are $7 to $8. And they are perfect for a grab-and-go breakfast or lunch, a weekend carb fest, an office bagel party. We turn now to the music section. Blurry Vision. As Hotchkopf strives to diversify, is the festival losing its center? I begin the climatic night of Hotchkopf with the decision to make Boulevards at Red Hat Amphitheater versus Speedy Ortiz at City Plaza. I like the local synth funkster and the visiting alt rockers equally well, and I might have to flip a coin if not for the Bullet Whiskey stand in City Plaza, where you could get four free shots, okay, half shots, but still, for the price of showing your ID and maybe selling your soul in a promotional snapshot with a spokesmodel in a cocktail dress. When domestic beers are going for $10, oh, that's a scale tipper. Speedy's spiky 90s indie throwbacks were perfect aperitif for the actual 90s rock of alt legend Liz Phair, who would take the stage next. Her singing, as punchy and pitchy as ever, her strumming as slashing and sure, Phair generously returned a fervent mouth-along audience to its glory days. Her concert was part of a slate of nostalgia bookings, MC50, A Prince-Less Revolution, Niles, Roger, and Schick, that strongly highlighted a focus on spectacularly checking demographic boxes at the expense of creating a cohesive, cumulative overall experience. The savvy, Speedy Phair pairing stood out among the more desultory bookings. Of course, a music festival should be eclectic and verse, but if it's to be more than a massive branding exercise, it should also tell a coherent, compelling story about what matters in music or culture right now, teaching listeners through narrative and association, not dartboarding bombardment. If the concept is basically, what if a rock festival, but Miguel, then what results is a strangely inert, inorganic cultural space, one in which a surprising number of core attendees have never heard of the headliner that indisputably gave the weekend's greatest set to one of the festival's smallest mainstay crowds, Nile Rodgers and Cheek. Rodgers is the flame keeper and inevitable guitarist of the legendary disco band behind Dance, Dance, Dance and Le Freak, and the writer-performer or producer on pop hits by anyone from Sister Sledge and Diana Ross to Duran Duran and Daft Punk. We heard them all. Rodgers' funk is still immaculately silvered and feathered, and the 65-year-old guitarist was backed by a hard-working drummer, two spectacular singers. It's a good thing Red Hat was already roofless, as Kimberly Davis would have torn it off. A sturdy bassist flinging notes around the neck whenever he wanted, two sidestepping horn players, and a keyboardist who teared up with Rodgers telling the cancer recovery store he must have heard 100 times before. I love bloopity electronic noises and people playing wind chimes through pedals, but that was goddamn band right there, and it slightly ruined me for the other music that night. Plus, everybody learned something. Rodgers produced Like a Virgin. Who knew? If Hotchkopf slacked on telling a story about music and its meaning this year, Chick picked it right up and made it dance. Out of a journalistic interest, I prized myself away and went back to the City Plaza to watch a bit of MC50. This is too bizarre for a segue, so I'll just blurt it out. Who remembers the baffling thing uttered by Wayne Kramer, the founding guitarist reanimating the corpse of the Detroit protopunk band Kicked Out the Jams, a canonical classic? I'm not sure anyone who wasn't young in 1968 still listened to it. I wish I had the exact quote, but between songs near the start of the set, Kramer definitely told the crowd that he saw a lot of white faces, but they had soulful hearts. He continued to develop this line of thought, but my mind was reeling so fast, I didn't register what he said next, though I had the impression it continued to be nuts. Some audience members got alert and still, as if a trap were about to spring, while some side-eyed each other as if they knew they'd be offended by what he was saying if only they could grasp out what it was or why he was saying it. If possible, Kramer was archly commenting on his audience's homogeneity somehow. But it didn't land that way, and satire hardly fits in the band's earnest messianic wheelhouse. Besides, dude, what did you expect? You're playing a half-a-century-old white counterculture touchstone in Raleigh. It seemed like he was always using soulful, as a flattering euphemism, trying to paint a middle-aged white audience with a cool black brush. But surely, not even someone representing the band that founded the White Panther Party would say that out loud into a microphone on a stage in 2018, right? Anyway, it was super, super weird. Someone help me out here. I'm not saying that Hopscotch having a white stage and a black stage on Saturday night was racist, but it indicates something it knows about its audience, something is not rising to challenge. After Schick, the lineup went almost completely pale again for hours, until Vic Mensa at 12:30, which, in the nightmarish sonic hellscape that is the basement, the concrete hangar below the Raleigh Convention Center, sounded like three different Bomb Squad productions playing at once inside a giant aluminum trash can. Hopscotch, I say this as a friend. Enough with the basement. Perhaps a more careful curated presentation would have made the transcendent Moses Sumney an oasis in this nocturnal desert, rather than planting him before dusk and before Schick, and then leaving pop fans adrift in a world of mind over mirrors and gang dance later. Sumney's cool effervescent digitalized soul, at once earthy and otherworldly, implied a sort of postmodern, even posthuman, Stevie Wonder. His ethereal runs and stark live backing extended into virtual space with live electronic processing. One of the most memorable moments on Saturday night, even though it took a couple of tries after some tech problems, was when Sumney entreated the crowd to group harmonize on a bass note as if he were Paulina Oliveros, weaving us into the composition in a way that felt authentic and augmenting, as if the great electronic bass were rolling out of my throat. If I'm being hard on a festival at which I had a good time, is because Hopscotch is established and popular enough to withstand it, and as it moves toward the center, it risks losing its unique local identity. In its early days, it catered to rock fans and focused on booking that weren't often seen in the area or other festivals. But many bands this year had been to Hopscotch before or tour in the region regularly. Hopscotch has been successful in branching out into experimental music and has made strides with rock and pop, but it has not yet figured out how to connect them so that they can talk to one another and their audiences cross over. The risk of the something-for-everyone approach is that none but the most eclectic, historically steep music nerds can get the most out of it. Many people will buy a ticket for the big show they want to see, or buy a wristband, and wander around without any clear path through the middle and experimental bands for long stretches. A festival can be inclusive without abdicating the need to tell a story beyond. Here are some popular or renowned acts we were able to schedule at this time. It was enough to make Hopscotch worthwhile, if not especially exciting this year, though our plea regarding the basement also applies to the Flaming Lips. The question is whether it will continue to be in the future. Also from the music section, Prince Charming. Will Oldham, songwriter, actor, storyteller, poet, unfolds his Bonnie Prince Billy catalog at Duke. The only reality that matters is the one that's being built as you listen, second by second, to this song, says singer-songwriter Will Oldham, describing the creative space he shares with his audience. Under the banners of Bonnie Prince Billy, Palace Brothers, and other permutations of the Palace moniker, Oldham has blurred the lines between folk, country, and underground experimentalism since the early 90s, earning a reputation as a true American original. While Oldham has never been a road dog, keeping his performance schedule to a minimum over the years, he's been a prolific recording artist, cutting some 25 albums since 1993 and an even greater number of EPs and one-off singles. The mercurial but unfailing vision fueling up these songs is one that has soaked up centuries of American folklore and found a way to funnel it through a contemporary sensibility. Through his work, Oldham simultaneously achieves a sui generis sort of otherworldliness and an accessible naturalistic quality. Though he demurs the distinction, just about every artist you can think of under the indie folk banner owes a debt to Oldham. This week, Oldham gives the admirers a peek behind the curtain. In a Duke University residence featuring a unique concert and a pair of lectures touching on his techniques for writing, performing, and recording, he'll have an unprecedented opportunity to lay every aspect of his artistry out on the table for inspection, leaving himself open to learning from the experience and sharing what he discovers with his audience. Oldham's earliest songwriting impetus came as a Louisville, Kentucky kid attending a summer camp in southern Indiana, the only Kentuckian in the bunch of Midwesterners. He says that at the time he was listening to the likes of Volcanic Suns, Minutemen, and Big Black. But around the campfire, he found that his fellow campers were more interested in acts like Neil Young and the Grateful Dead, and especially fellow Hoosier John Cougar Mellencamp. All these campers bonded with songs like Casey Jones and Small Town or Neil Young's Cortez the Killer. They were specific songs that seemed to help this group of people identify themselves, Oldham says. When I see what a song does to other people, I think, oh, that's really what you want to do, is make a song that people have shared experience with. It should be about something as collective as possible. By the time Oldham started recording his own songs under the Palace Brothers' name in 1992, traditional folk music had become a part of the artistic equation, too. His sideline in acting, which was encompassed in numerous films and theater roles over the years, led to an epiphany. My theatrical ambitions had been to figure out how to leave my life and enter the life of characters. That's what I thought an actor did. And similarly then, I thought, I'm not going to be able to do that in acting. Maybe I can do it with music, he said. He realized he needed to find albums and artists where there's no makeup or construction that needs to happen before the song starts playing, which he found in folk music and field recordings. I just thought, I want to create music that exists and record it rather than build it to be recorded, he said. Oldham accordingly folded folk influences into his songwriting, often crafting melodies that sound like they could have been written in a bygone era if not for some eccentric lyrical touches. A key opponent for Oldham's work is the way he balances anachronistic language with modern imagery and perspectives to create songs that somehow stand outside of time. From his first single, The Palliser Brother, Ohio Riverboat Song, a tune that could have fallen off of Harry Smith's anthology of American folk music, to 1999's I See a Darkness, a foreboding tomb silence sounding enough for Johnny Cash himself, who covered it on 2000's America 3, Solitary Man. I remember first hearing bluesman Bucca White or Washington Phillips and just thinking it was the most effective and contemporary and pertinent music. I heard it then, and as I heard it, and it should have been able to be heard from years ago. These are recordings that were made in the 20s and 30s, I think, Oldham said. His visceral connection to these vintage classics gave him a touchstone for balancing old and new ideas without sounding anachronistic. I'm not trying to recall the past with anything, says Oldham of his occasional antiquarian lyrical tendencies. It's more like, well, I want to build a house that takes some technology from a certain area because those houses are still standing. Not because those houses look cooler, necessarily, but because those houses are still standing. That's the technology that I may trust more than technology that's being utilized in the modern construction of a house. The construction of Oldham's records began in a resolutely DIY arena. He recorded his first full-length Palace Brothers record, 1993's There Is No One That Will Take Care of You, on an 8-track cassette recorder in whatever spaces they could. That meant houses rather than stately recording studios. There's a lot of wonderful records that mean the world to me that are recorded in recording studios. But I was sort of liking the idea that if you chose a non-studio space and record in it, by opening up the microphones and pushing record, you're bringing in something from that space. You're not listening to a sterile universal space like a recording studio or a dentist's office. You're listening to a space that no record has ever been recorded in before. This idea dovetails neatly with Oldham's desire to create songs that exist outside the recording studio. Over the years, both Oldham's recording techniques and his initially unschooled singing underwent a significant amount of refinement. He recorded in Nashville with country sessions musicians for 2004's Bonnie Prince Billy Sings Greatest Palace Music, collaborated with post-rock heroes Tortoise on the 2006 cover album The Brave and the Bold, and made many more expansive excursions from the Nico Mui orchestrated The Letting Go to the ambient trance folk of Epic Jammers and Fortunate Little Ditties. Oldham's approach to songwriting is in a constant state of evolution, too. Though he's often written in character, self-reflection has crept in. In the past, I think I would have always said that I was not building songs based on my inner life, he said. As years have gone on, I start to realize there's so much that I was fooling myself about in terms of what I was allowing into the songs that pulled directly from or paralleled my verifiable existence. And surprisingly, for someone widely regarded as a sophisticated song poet, even the very function of lyrics is up for grabs in Oldham's writing. Most of the big, great Rolling Stones song that I love, I don't really understand what they're saying. And those songs are monsters, he said. Do I want to make music that's like what I would call Rolling Stones music, which ultimately is not lyric-based music, versus something like Richard Thompson, which is lyric-based music? You understand every word that's sung, and you understand how the words fit together from beginning to end. All the facets of Oldham's perspective on record-making, song-building, and live performance will come under the artist's own microscope at his Duke residency. On September 26th, he'll deliver his Making Songs lecture at Sound Pure Studio, letting attendees in on his recording secrets. The next night, his recording and performing songs discussion will occur at the same spot. And on the 28th, in Duke's Baldwin Auditorium, a truly special concert will occur. Louis Jazzman, James Duncan crafted new arrangements for a batch of songs from all across Oldham's career. For a lineup including sax, clarinet, tuba, trombone, violin, cello, and double bass. "They require that I relearn songs that I've been playing for almost 30 years," says Oldham. "Not just, oh, there's a retrospective set. It's not like that at all. This is new. This is fresh to me." The impending arrival of the book Songs of Love and Horror, Collected Lyrics of Will Oldham, due to be published by W.W. Norton in early October, coincides perfectly with the residency. "It felt like a good thing to do with this lyric book coming out," affirms Oldham. "I wanted to re-explore older songs because that's what the book is doing, to try to parallel that in some way, but kind of drastically." The frequently spotlighted Shunning Oldham relishes the opportunity for a one-of-a-kind interaction with his audience. "We're inviting people into a small space that is ostensibly a professional music space. Something will transpire there, and stories will be told, and information and emotion ideally relayed that couldn't be reproduced or experienced in any other way. And that's very appealing." In closing, the staff... A final thought. We, at this, as part of the staff of the Triangle Radio Reading Service, would like to wish well as we come to the end of the Florence, of the Hurricane of Florence. We in the Triangle area did a lot better than a lot of people in the state. We are thankful for that. But we hope you might take cognizance of the article that appeared earlier. And if there's some way that you can assist others that didn't come out as fortunately as we did, to think of them. God bless. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And notice that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.